This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. We're going to take a look today at a big anniversary we celebrated in 2016. The National Park Service turned 100 on August 25th, and over the last year, the WMRA brought you the history and sounds of, and also damage to, one jewel in the national park system, right here in our part of Virginia, Shenandoah National Park. It was quite a year for the park, which celebrated the Park Service's anniversary just months after suffering its second largest wildfire in recorded history. The park also selected its very own sound artist, Diane Ballin, in July to record what you may hear, whether natural or man-made, on a visit along one of the trails just off Skyline Drive. We will hear those stories from WMRA's Jordy Yeager in just a bit, and also a kind of Christmassy Our Island universe. But first, a look back at the somewhat troubling history of the creation of Shenandoah National Park. Since it opened in late 1935, the park has welcomed an average of well over 1.5 million visitors each year. Many of them may not know of the park's painful past, though. One avid hiker who researched and wrote about that past calls her book a broken-hearted love song to the park. As WMRA's Christopher Clymer Kurtz reports in this story from September.
I'm a hiker. I love the park. But I'm devastated about what happened. How can I live with myself being a hiker in that park?
Northern Virginia resident and writer Sue Eisenfeld says her 2015 book, titled Shenandoah, A Story of Conservation and Betrayal, actually tells three stories. How Virginia and the federal government created Shenandoah National Park, what happened to the people who had been living there, and her own journey of discovery and understanding.
In some ways, I really was looking for grace because I want to keep hiking there. It can't be all bad, and it isn't all bad. It's this beautiful, preserved place that millions of people enjoy every year.
Eisenfeld spoke last week to a crowded room at James Madison University, a guest of Special Collections, which houses some of the documents Eisenfeld used in her research. Already there were many books about the park, but as an avid hiker there for years, she came across many artifacts like pottery shards, farm equipment, engines, wagon wheels, and more. She felt she had to make sense of the history for herself.
If we had to create this park by throwing out thousands of people and dispossessing them, what kind of people do that? And what kind of people do that in the way it was done, i.e. handcuffing people, physically dragging them away, burning down their homes? This actually happened to some people in the park. You know, others took the money that they were paid and left, and some were okay with it. Some were happy to move into the lowlands, so I don't want to say that everyone was dispossessed, but what kind of people did this?
To research, Eisenfeld hiked to cemeteries, old foundations of homes and barns, orchards. She interviewed descendants of park residents, studied maps, deeds, National Park Service records. One force behind the creation of the park was William Carson, who Eisenfeld calls a big guy in Virginia history. Eisenfeld felt she had to get to know this man, whose work to create something so beautiful caused so many people so much pain.
For me, the complete turning point of the writing of the book happened because I found one sheet of paper. It was one letter that kind of changed everything for me in terms of William Carson.
She explains that letter and its effect on her in her book. Eisenfeld's research also led her to JMU's Special Collections interviews with former residents, like this one from 1978, in which Maddie Yeager talks about her father.
My daddy danced all night long, every dance that come up. He was a powerful dancer right up till he died, and he was 80 years old when he danced the dance and didn't word you out. So a flat to the floor dance. He didn't go up high. You see, I had a brother.
Virginia Taylor was among those in the audience at Eisenfeld's book talk. Afterwards, she said her grandfather, Glenn, then age 17, was among those evicted from park land in 1936.
He always had a pretty surly attitude about what happened.
She said his family had farmed the land there for about 200 years. That sense of longevity helped draw Eisenfeld into the park's story.
This was my first exposure to people who had been here for generations, who had fought in the Revolution, War of 1812, Civil War. And I guess I had just never known a lot of people who'd been here that long. And I really came to feel attached to them and felt like I cared about their families as if they were my own.
Eisenfeld said that for many descendants of the park's former residents, especially those that still live nearby, the pain of the loss continues.
It has not diminished for them. They feel raw emotion, as if it happened yesterday and not 80 years ago.
The government's use of its power of eminent domain in the establishment of national parks is not unique to the history of the Shenandoah National Park. It has played a role in the formation or expansion of Rock Creek, Mammoth Cave, Great Smoky Mountains, and Everglades National Parks, as well as Big Cypress National Preserve, the Redwood National Forest, and more. For author Sue Eisenfeld, researching and writing about the Shenandoah National Park's painful past led her to the grace she was looking for as a hiker on sacred ground.
I was looking for a way that I could feel like it was okay to be here. And both from my research and also just meeting people, I felt like they were saying to me, it's okay to be here.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer Kurtz.
When most of us think of an artist in residence, we think of a painter, a potter, or maybe even a poet. But what about an artist whose medium is sound? Well, that perked the ears of WMRA's Jordy Yeager, who tagged along with the park's artist in residence in this report from August.
On a recent Wednesday, the sun had barely risen, and parking lots along the winding Skyline Drive were still empty, except for one car. Outside it, a woman from Portland, Maine, gently made her way down one of the most popular trails in Shenandoah National Park. She was the first one out that day, and she was on a mission.
My name is Diane Ballin. I am a sound artist, and I am the artist in residence at Shenandoah National Park. We've come down to Dark Hollow Falls to record some of the falls, and this is actually my first recording at the park.
Chances are you've heard Ballin's work. She's been making radio since back in the 1980s when cassette recorders were cutting edge. But her pieces aren't your standard who, what, where, why reports like this one. Rather, they're works of art, like poetic sound.
When I saw Diane's application and it was for a sound installation, I was immediately intrigued.
Lisa Wilkolak is an administrative assistant for natural and cultural resources at Shenandoah National Park.
Then I went online and listened to all of her recordings that she has available and just thought it was such a unique and different way to look at a place that people often assume is just a physical beauty and people don't necessarily pay attention to the sounds that they hear. So I was interested in hearing what she heard when she visited us.
Back in Dark Hollow Falls, Ballin puts down her giant microphone, takes off her large headphones, and stops her recorder.
What I love about sound is that we create the visuals. The sound creates a visual. With video or film, which is also, a beautiful art, the visual is created for you. I really love the challenge of creating visual with sound and how personal that is to the person who's listening, as well as the producer.
Birds, waterfalls, streams, scurrying squirrels, sure. But there's another key sound in these woods.
Hey, we're at Dark Hollow Falls. It's about 9 a.m. I just jumped in the swimming hole at the bottom of the falls and stood underneath the falls. Quite refreshing, better than a cup of coffee.
Dennis Mathewson is a physical therapist from Amherst, Massachusetts. He and his family are vacationing in the park like dozens of others Ballin talks with over the course of the morning. An IT manager and a middle school teacher from Chicago, a pair of best friends from Indiana and New York, a family from London, another from Austria, all have come to experience the wild of the park.
I love it. Nothing like nature. I mean, this is where we belong. If you sit there in the quiet is almost like a physical presence, and you just sit there and you feel part of it,
Tom Knuth has come all the way from Wisconsin.
Just went out alone in the woods. Yeah. It becomes a physical presence. I can almost feel the silence. You almost, reach out and grab it. I get emotional about it. It's really pretty cool.
Knuth's not alone in getting choked up. Almost everyone we meet has a visceral reaction to being in the park, and Ballin is there to capture it. Wilkolak says that in just the 1 week that she spent with Ballin, it's changed how she sees, or rather, here's the park.
My favorite part is that she gets so excited about sounds, and everything she hears, she's thinking about the possibility of using it or how it applies to something. So she looks at the world in a different way. She looks at the world through sound, And it's made me spend time listening and seeing the world through sound rather than sight or smell.
Balance pieces aren't gratuitous. She doesn't use sound just to fill space. Whether the focus is on dogs and their owners, or bird watchers, or boats creaking on docks in Iceland, Balan creates audio journeys where every sound is a guidepost, a subtle move and transition within the piece, delicately shaping and charting a broader story. Here at the park, she's not exactly sure what form the eventual piece will take quite yet, but she guesses it'll be about 10 minutes long. It'll live at the visitor center near Big Meadows for people from all over the world to come experience. For now, she's happy just basking in the sounds.
I don't worry about, you know, how it's going to work. I just am there at the moment. I think this, to me, this is the best part of recording, because you're not sitting at the bench saying, oh, you know, there's that sound in the background I don't want. It's like discovery. And you don't know exactly what you're going to get. And it's always a beautiful surprise.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Now, for a look back at Shenandoah National Park's Big April Fire, it was the second largest forest fire in the park's recorded history. In a two-part report, combined into one piece here, Jordy recounted how fire teams fought that 10,000-acre blaze, and then he took a hike into the backcountry with park rangers to see the long-term effects, damage, and signs of life.
It was a typical Saturday afternoon when Matthew Way got the call.
There was a smoke report called into our dispatch center, said there was a fire on the park. Dispatch called me, and then I responded down.
Way is the assistant fire management officer for Shenandoah National Park, which encompasses nearly 200,000 acres from Front Royal all the way south to Waynesboro. For more than a dozen years, Way worked on the Augusta Hotshot crew, so he's seen his fair share of fires. But that Saturday in April, when he responded to the call for smoke, he was surprised.
The fire column was already, you know, three or four times the size of what I was anticipating. It was already, you know, in a slightly different spot than where it was reported, which tells me that it's growing. You know, it's moving.
And move it did. By the end of the day, the fire had spread across 69 acres. A full 48 hours later, and it was burning through 2,100 acres.
We still don't know for sure what caused the fire, but pretty sure it's human-caused. Mm-hmm. Most likely an escaped campfire. Somebody was probably camping out there and had a fire and didn't put it out completely.
Sally Hurlbert is a management specialist with the park. Standing at the Brown Mountain Overlook near mile marker 75 along Skyline Drive, Hurlbert is pointing to a giant map of the valley below us.
So this is where the smoke was reported, and the first priority that day was to get people out of this area who were hiking those trails.
Working with local law enforcement, Way says they got everyone to safety without incident. Then, he says, the hard part began. Every fire is different, and first things first, he had to figure out what he was dealing with.
For me, I was already boots on the ground on the trail system, so I just walked up the trail till I hit the fire's edge and then started assessing it from there.
Not only was the fire larger than originally thought, but it was spreading faster, and it was 5 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. Resources, he says, were going to be hard to come by.
That Saturday night, you know, we placed an order for a couple of Type 1 hand crews, you know, some engines, and some other miscellaneous positions that we immediately needed. And those orders were being filled from New Mexico, you know, so that's the closest available resource. So, you know, we have some hotshot crews here in the East Coast, but due to fire behavior, you know, other fires in the area, they were committed. We couldn't get a local crew until Monday.
In total, more than 350 firefighters came from over 30 states to help battle the blaze. And while getting more crews on the scene more quickly would have helped, Way says that it likely wouldn't have made a significant difference, mainly because of the terrain. It would become known as the Rocky Mount Fire, and as the name suggests, much of the engulfed area consisted of loose rock slides on steep slopes surrounded by burning trees and leaf litter. In other words, not the type of fire you want to rush into head on.
Yeah, the more people you have, the more chances there are for someone to get injured, for something bad to happen. And committing a lot of resources into a piece of ground that is very remote and very rocky, very steep, is not necessarily the best plan. You know, it's much easier to give up a little bit of ground, back up to favorable terrain, put your lines in place, and then just do a light back burn to kind of secure it, versus trying to chase it down direct and putting people in a very bad position.
Thankfully, a hurt knee and ankle were the only human injuries. Where they could, fire teams used existing hiking trails as natural buffers, attempting to halt the fire's advance by using chainsaws to cut down trees and leaf blowers to remove brush that the fire could have used for fuel. And where the terrain proved too treacherous, helicopters were brought in, dropping small flammable ping pong balls to burn portions of the ground, again in an attempt to use up the tree and brush fuel in the path of the rapidly spreading fire. By April 29th, the fire had spread over 10,300 acres, making it the second largest in the park's 80 years of existence. But finally, after nearly 2 weeks and $4 million, it was contained. And 3 weeks later, it was deemed officially out. It's been about 6 months since then, and as we sit in his giant pickup truck on Skyline Drive, Wei points to the surrounding leaves that are beginning to fall from the trees. We're entering into another fire season, he says.
You know, for us, we look at dryness. So we're tracking days since rain, how much rain we're getting out of each rainstorm, and trying to determine, you know, just how dry the woods are getting. We'll be watching the weather pretty hard for the next 2 months.
Pray for rain.
Yep.
Yeah.
And snow.
And snow, right.
So look over here. See, the fire only went up the tree a little ways.
Sally Hurlbert is a management specialist with the Shenandoah National Park. We're walking along a trail near the Brown Mountain Overlook. Just 6 months ago, this area was engulfed in fire.
So here we go. This little area right here was what we would consider a high-intensity burn. And so several of these trees have died. Not all of them, though. That's what's interesting. You can have two trees right next to each other. One died and one didn't.
Back in April, the Rocky Mount fire burned through more than 10,000 acres of the park in less than 2 weeks.
And see how high up the black area is on the trees? That just shows you how high the fire went. It actually crowned in those trees. And that's just not all that typical for oak trees to do that, but it was so dry.
More than 350 firefighters coming from over 30 states fought the blaze at a cost of nearly $4 million. But now, the park is bouncing back. Hurlbert pulls out a picture taken just days after the fire. It shows a hillside of charred stumps and blackened brush. Today, that very same hillside is flush with green and abundant vegetation. And it's not just plants and trees that are coming back.
I was just going to go turn over a rock or two and see if we can see anything. Well, you have to come really close, but there's a little millipede baby. Ooh. Tiny little guy.
And now what does that tell you?
That tells me that they can hide under the rocks and the fire burns over and around them. But as long as they're underground, it's cooler, it's wetter under a rock, so it's easier for little things to survive.
And where little things survive, bigger things do too.
Okay, so here is an example of where a bear has rolled a rock. The rock used to be right there, now it's rolled over. So it's looking for food here in the burn area.
With about 1 to 2 bears per square mile in the park, wildlife specialists estimate that perhaps 15 to 20 bears were displaced by the blaze. But animals have pretty good instincts when it comes to fire, even when they're caused by humans, as rangers say this likely was. Also, they say not all fires are all bad.
This area hasn't burned in so long, it helped to clear out those hazardous fuels that had built up for a number of years. So a fire that occurs in the future now will have less to burn.
Andy Ruth is a fire ecologist planner with the National Park Service. Ruth explains that fire actually helps some trees reproduce. Shenandoah is home to several types of pines that have what are called serotonous cones, pine cones that require fire to open up and regenerate.
In addition to that, it helps to kill in these oak areas. Sometimes maples will come in and start dominating these areas. So it helps to girdle these maples and allow for oak species to come in and regenerate.
For centuries, fire was an integral part of forest management. But in 1910, that all changed, as nearly 3 million acres burned uncontrollably over 2 days in Montana, Idaho, and Washington, killing 87 people in the process. In the decades following, federal policy shifted dramatically towards minimizing fires and safeguarding against potential casualties. The park still does regular prescribed burns, though, Ruth says, waiting for the exact right weather and conditions so as to control the blaze as best as possible.
So you may have an area that hasn't burned in a number of years, and so, you know, there might be a lot of dead and down woody debris that you need to consume. A lot of these systems around here, like the oak systems, are fire tolerant,
and they existed with fire, you know, historically. And so to perpetuate the oaks, you need to burn them.
The typical natural time between fires is 3 to 10 years, say Ruth and Hurlburt.
And that's also why we think the Rocky Mountain fire burned so much hotter than normal, because there hadn't been a fire in there in 80 years or more. And so that fuel load had built up to a catastrophic level.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. Adorned atop many a Christmas tree this season will be a star. The Christmas Star, or Star of Bethlehem, is thought to have led the Magi to Bethlehem and to a manger. But what was the Christmas Star? Is it even possible to scientifically ask the question? The answer, of course, is yes. The Florentine painter Giotto famously painted the Christmas Star as a comet in his Adoration of the Magi. But this is likely the result of him seeing Halley's Comet in 1301. But comets in ancient times were often depicted as harbingers of doom, so a comet as the Christmas Star is unlikely. Another possibility is a supernova, the cataclysmic explosion of a massive star. However, such a transient phenomenon would have been observed to many and likely even visible during the day. We know the Chinese, for example, made detailed records of supernovae that they observed. But according to biblical records, King Herod asked the Magi to point out the star they were following. A supernova would have been obvious to all. The Magi, often translated as wise men, likely means astrologers in this context. These were early astronomers who studied the sky and were familiar with the wandering stars or planets from night to night. So for them, planets seen in particular constellations would have had great significance. The two best ideas for the Star of Bethlehem is either the triple conjunction of the planets Jupiter and Saturn in the constellation Pisces the Fish, seen in 7 BC, or the double conjunction of Jupiter and the Moon in the constellation Aries the Ram, seen in 6 BC. Both of these events would have been significant to those watching the skies and interpreting the motions they observed to events on Earth. For the John C. Wells Planetarium, I'm Chanel Varani.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bib and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Ham and Jim Huggins, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio, and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.